There was one article that came out in a magazine that said that I was like a food doctor, but I don't know if I really am. Although some people think I have a PhD, I don't actually have one. So some people do call me Dr. Masoni, which is pretty funny.
Hey, welcome back to PDX Food Stories. I'm your host, Mary Crow, and today on the podcast, I have Sarah Masoni from the Food Innovation Center in Portland, Oregon. Later in the show, Sarah and Dirk Marshall are back, and we talk cherry tomatoes, how to use them, how to preserve them, and what chefs around town are doing with this seasonal summer favorite. Sarah Masoni is a product development manager at the Food Innovation Center, where she has worked for the last 17 years focusing on micro-enterprise and entrepreneurs in our state. In her work, she helps businesses address hurdles such as pH and Brix levels, as well as shelf life studies and scaling their business. The Food Innovation Center is an amazing resource, and not just for producers and large businesses looking to capture insights into what Portlanders think about food, but also for our community at large. There's some really fun and interesting programs coming up at the Food Innovation Center, so do check the website, pdxfoodstories.com. I'll be linking to all those after the show. All right, enjoy.
Yep. A lot of crazy foods start in Oregon.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what are some of your favorite products and favorite small brands that you've seen come through the Innovation Center?
One of the brands that I really enjoy watching grow is Cheds. Mm. They make a little cheese snack stick, sort of like cheese straws from the South, but they're made with all local Oregon cheddar. You might mm-hmm. guess whose cheddar's in it, and then local butter.
Wow.
And they're a low-carb snack, and they're mm-hmm. really delightful. That's a great project and product. And then I like a company that's out of Tillamook, actually. It's called Scout Organics. Mm-hmm. And they have a line of fruit and nut bars that are really delightful. Mm-hmm. Chef Vitaly Paley, he has the Paley bar that actually is more like a block of fruit and nut that's mm-hmm. actually now sold in the cheese case. Pretty happy with that. And a couple of years ago, we had a big story that hit the news about seaweed, actually,
right,
that was grown down in Newport, Oregon. And that actually is used in some of the restaurants around Portland, and we're continuing to work on having commercial products with that product.
What are some of the surprises, I guess, you know, small people who have this great concept and they come with a sample to you, you know, they're creating, they've got the juices and the energy to create this product that's unique, and they feel like it's, you know, the market wants it,
mm-hmm.
but then there's the food safety and the business side. So what are some of the things that pop up for them that are big surprises?
I think the biggest surprise for people is that people actually want to buy their product.
Really?
and that means they have to make more of it.
So scaling.
Yeah. So, yeah. And also, you know, the funding to bridge that gap of being able to produce a small amount and fill a couple of stores, and then suddenly having 20 stores.
Right.
And having all the responsibility of having the inventory of ingredients and packaging.
Sure.
And then when people decide I need to have 3 versions of this or 5, that just multiplies out the financial responsibility.
Right.
To the brand.
Yeah.
So that's probably the toughest part, is the money.
Right. Yes, because you can hand label for a few orders,
mm-hmm.
and then when you're going to 20 to 50 stores, to a few states, all of a sudden, those little things that you didn't think about.
Yeah, so perseverance, patience,
yeah.
and being able to stick with it, even when it becomes mundane.
Right.
Because one of the things that happens when you're going through the entrepreneurial part of growing a business is that the things that you're learning for the first time are very new, exciting, and challenging. But once mm-hmm. you learn those things, they become routine.
Right.
And so you have that cortisol, adrenaline mm-hmm. sort of rush, you know, as you're learning and getting it and doing it right the first time. And then suddenly it just becomes something that you have to do
mm-hmm.
instead of something that you want to do. And so when you get to a point in your progression of having a lot of the same thing happening over and over again, and you need to move on to something new. You need to make sure and surround yourself with people who have a vision and that buy into your dream and that are good people that maybe you could have on staff or on contract to help you keep the business growing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely does. Yeah. I mean, I think that's something to think about for any career, really. Mm-hmm. As you said, you get really excited, you're learning, you're growing. A couple of years down the line, it feels very stagnant. How do you stay invested?
Yes.
When you've lost the rush.
Yeah, and even for me, I see things that I can do very quickly and easily are actually new and interesting to other people, but for me it's kind of like, yeah, you need that information, okay, and then I just sort of barf it up for them and try and go on to the next thing. And one of the things I'm interested in doing now is actually seeing about having maybe classes at the Food Innovation Center that are dealing with cheese. So for cheese enthusiasts, maybe we'll have a 2-hour session where we learn all about Alpine cheeses, or we learn all about French cheeses or something like that. I was thinking, I was just at the American Cheese Society in Denver last week, and I judged cheese for like the 8th or 9th time for them. And I went to a class talking about teaching people about cheese, and I thought, gosh, I want to do that at the Food Innovation Center. So that is like my entrepreneurial side saying, I need to do something else.
Right.
Like, I sort of got this all figured out.
Right.
Now what else can I do to keep myself motivated and interested in helping grow the food community in Portland?
Well, I think that's a great segue into the event we were at last night, which is the, see if I can get the whole name right. Is it the Oregon Agriculture Crop Up Dinners?
It was a specialty crop block grant, which is a federally funded program, and it's managed through the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Got it.
And we came up with the name Crop Up because it was basically a pop-up dinner, but we were celebrating specialty crops, so we called it Crop Up. And one of the ideas behind it was to create foods all from these specialty crops that are grown in Oregon, which I guess there's about 120 of them. And we actually grow over 220 different crops in Oregon. So over 50% of what we grow in Oregon in ag is specialty crop. And people don't really know what specialty crop means. It's kind of a fanciful name.
Yes.
And it basically means tomatoes, watermelon, plums, apricots, green beans, Christmas trees of all things are specialty crop and nursery items. So we put together a nice meal. We invest in food from the local area. So we purchased all the fruits and vegetables that we used from growers in the Eugene area last night. And then we had a few dishes with a little bit of salmon and shrimp to highlight. They're not specialty crops. It has to be grown on the land. And had a little bit of a farmer's market. And each of the people that attended got 5 coupons to spend at the market, which was actually, we reimbursed the farmers. And we used actually the funds that people paid to come to actually pay for those tickets. So it was kind of...
Well, when I received the invitation, I thought, when I read through it, I thought, oh, this is an event for buyers. And I'm not a buyer in my day job, but I'm going to go. And when I got there and just realizing, you know, this was the public, general public who are interested.
For the public,
people who were in some way related to ag, whether through farm-to-school programs or community programs. Then there were maybe some grocery people there. And I loved, it felt like just a really pure version of what we talk about when we talk about community. Because the message of how important ag is and how we need to invest and how we need to get our kids excited about this food was spread, I really feel like, to the right people, because it wasn't the choir necessarily, because it was open to the public.
Yeah, it's a cross-section for sure. And the interesting thing is when people would sign in, we'd ask them just for a preliminary survey to find out if they knew what specialty crops were. And since this event was held in a school cafeteria was very interesting because the Department of Agriculture has produced a series of specialty crop posters that mm-hmm. they have in every lunchroom in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And many people, even some of the farms that came, that checked in, didn't realize what the specialty crops were. And so I would say, well, you might just look around right. the room here and see those posters over there. There's like a watermelon, right. like
asparagus, a strawberry, peas, asparagus. Yeah.
Those are specialty crops.
Because you hear like, specialty and you think it must be...
Yeah, the value added or yes, something. But right. the value add is that the farms are growing, harvesting, and delivering. So the harvest and the deliver is actually the value add for me. So
got
I
it.
Wouldn't really... and, you know, getting it to people, like right. making that direct sale.
So we've covered, you know, your work one-on-one with small businesses mm-hmm. and what the innovation Food Innovation Center does for them. But then this public side of things, so mm-hmm. like that dinner last night was really kind of one of those first public events where I thought, oh, I have a connection to this just as, you know, the general public. And now you're mentioning cheese classes. So
yeah.
how do you see the Food Innovation Center's relationship to the general public at large and the food community and conditioning, you know, growing our ideas around investing in local food?
Yeah. So I think maybe by default have ended up being sort of like a meeting, a place where sort of things intersect
mm-hmm.
and then things go out from. So if you were to look at for instance, a kitchen table with many chairs around it, we're sort of that table, and then each of the groups that we work with around the state and even the nation and the world now
mm-hmm.
are those chairs that move in and out from the mm-hmm. table depending on what's going on. In fact, one of the things that I see happening now is we're having more presence at international tables. We've traveled to Chile. We have people next week coming from Nigeria to learn about product development. We have people going to Japan in October. We have people going to the Netherlands. So we're actually spreading the style of work that we do to the rest of the world, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And then for the community, we have a program where we do sensory testing here, and we have a database of over 30,000 consumers from around Portland and the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that we actually touch consumers on a pretty large scale through having them come in and taste food for us.
Right.
And anybody can sign up for that and become a person that gets invited to fill out what we call a screener.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get screened, and then depending on their responses, may or may not be invited to come in and taste food and then get paid for it. So that's a huge community mm-hmm. involvement on a very direct level. As far as us having the bandwidth to, like, distribute more information out on a very, like, public level, we just... sadly don't have the staff.
Sure.
So we have to carefully pick and choose our events and how we do that. And one of the first kind of things that we started doing were having these public meals
mm-hmm.
where in a fairly short amount of time we could reach between 100 and 200 people
right
in a specific community and travel around two very different communities and repeat that and we've been doing that over the last 2 years. And I think we'll be doing a lot of that moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we just don't like have an endless pot of money either.
Right.
So we have to write a grant, mm-hmm. you know, get the funding, and then sort of plan out what we can do based on funding.
And there are 4 more crop-up dinners?
Yeah, we have one next on the 17th in Coos Bay, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And then there's 2 in September, one in Boardman and one in Madras, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And then on October 7th, there's Egg Days at the Capitol. And on Saturday the 7th, there'll be another crop-up style event during the lunch hour.
Great.
Yeah.
So back to that international and national conversation, in my research about the center, I was reading that, so in addition to small companies coming in and mm-hmm. working with you on product development, you will have large national or international companies come in and do focus groups here.
Yeah.
Because they want the Portland take on their product. What's so special about the Portland consumer that...
So for me, if I were to describe the Portland consumer, I would say that we're what I would call early adapters. Mm-hmm. So we have people who are willing to try new things and sort of give their opinions. I think people in Portland have a lot of opinions about food, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I've traveled all over the place, and we have really great food here. And I think that's why a lot of people are here, because of food, and food is a big central part of their lives. And so that's one thing that we can all agree on, is that we love food here in Portland. So that's why we have that huge database.
Right.
And so if a food company, you could think of any large food company, is coming up with a new idea.
Right.
And it's kind of out there.
Yep.
And they need to verify that these people who are open to trying new things mm-hmm. think it might be viable with their responses, then they oftentimes come here to Portland and have people taste it.
Is there anything consistently that these companies are surprised to hear when they do their tastings?
I think mostly they're probably confirming, usually.
Yeah.
When they're fairly large, they've usually distilled things down to a very specific level.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're just using that quantitative information, or,
right,
you know, it's not just subjective, which you actually had asked me earlier, like, how do food entrepreneurs sort of distill down to know that their product idea is a good one?
Mm-hmm.
They a lot of times don't have the luxury of being able to invest a lot of money on testing consumers,
right,
but they have the ability to act fast, and they have passion.
Right.
Which that passion is really hard to carry over as a company gets larger.
Right.
And that has to do with how you manage people and information. Mm-hmm. And I will oftentimes meet with middle management people that are working in a company. They may have, you know, try and figure stuff out. Or I go on a tour and they're like saying, oh man, I'm so tired of this. And what am I going to do? And I always say to them, you have to remember this one thing. You are working inside of someone else's dream. Mm. This may not be your dream, but it is your job to make that other person's dream a success. And when I tell people that, they just like look at me and they go, oh, yeah, that makes sense now. And it like takes this like pressure off. It's really interesting sort of to like reset people's ideas of why they're doing something that way.
Right.
Yeah, it's helpful.
I've been listening and reading a lot lately about, you know, these larger companies, Kraft, General Mills. They're having these smaller kind of innovation labs where they're buying, you know, smaller companies. And now, yes, like the dreams of the small producer is in their hand, but it is infusing some energy into, you know, this large corporation that they haven't felt in a long time, because there's so much passion behind this product.
Yeah.
It's part of what they're buying is not just this great product, but it is the passion of the team who started it.
So we've had some recent buyouts. Pacific Foods sold to Campbell's. Better Bean sold to Hain Celestial. And from what I know, what I've seen, I think that you're exactly right. They're trying to expand out,
right,
for sure. Sales are flat mm-hmm. in the grocery store on the aisles.
Yep.
And they're trying to figure out how to innovate. And a lot of times the corporate structure is really has been set up in a way to control things. And so it sort of negates that creativity and the entrepreneurship mm-hmm. that's needed to sort of get things going.
Right.
And I think in some instances it may work for a large company to buy a smaller one, but you know, big companies don't always just buy small companies for the brand. Sometimes they buy it because they don't want the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll actually manage the product into a smaller brand and use it to leverage the brands that they already have on the shelf.
Right.
And I think one of the things that entrepreneurs need to know is that a business is not just about producing widgets. It's about creating a business that actually can be sold.
Yeah.
And I think that when people take on a role as an entrepreneur and they set up a corporation, they need to understand the true responsibility to that corporation. Because once they set up that corporate entity, they're actually a steward to that corporation, and they need to make very good, prudent decisions to make sure that that company runs correctly, you know, that they're strategic.
Right.
They understand what they want it to be. Is this a local company only? Is it just supporting the Portland area? Is this a company that sells to Spokane and Seattle? Is it a company that mainly produces here and ships everything down to Los Angeles?
That seems like a very far away place from the, you know, the conception of your product to having to consider all of these options about your business. But that's what you guys do here, right?
Yeah.
Help people think through.
But we also have partners at the Small Business Development Center.
Right.
Over at the Climb Center, and there's a program called Getting Your Recipe to Market.
Right.
Started quite a few years ago, originated here at the Food Innovation Center, and then was transferred to Portland Community College, where it's managed. And every year we have two sessions, a spring and a fall, and then we have a big buyer event, and we'll have one in the middle of December here, and we call it the Holiday Bazaar. And then the summer we have more of a farmer style market, and we create, you know, about 30 companies a year that way.
That's amazing.
And we've done a little bit of research, and it seems like we have about a 40% success rate.
Wow.
Which is pretty high.
Yeah. That is really high. That's great.
Yeah.
And so that is through PCC.
Yeah.
Got it.
The Climb Center over by OMSI.
We'll link to that on the show notes.
Yeah. And something else that we've been working on is creating avenues for our vendors or our food entrepreneurs to meet up with buyers. And so we are working right now with Northwest Food Processors, and there's going to be a big brand new buyer event at the Northwest Food Processors show in January. And we've set aside 100 booths for entrepreneurs to set up their, you know, their trade. And then we're actually actively recruiting buyers from all over the U.S.
That's great.
And we have a little stipend to help help them be able to fly into Portland for that event.
Yeah. So removing barriers on both sides to getting people there.
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
So I was like, gosh, we keep creating all these great food companies. Yeah. I guess we should really try and figure out how to help them sell the products.
Right.
So that's one of the things I've been kind of focusing on for the last 3 or 4 years is building up relationships with buyers.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. But before I let you go, because this is such a great food city.
Yeah.
What are just your top three? You know, someone comes in from out of town and says, I've never been here. Where should I go? What are the few places that you rattle off?
I'm a real ice cream person, so it depends. Like, if the person likes ice cream, I tell them to go to 50 Licks.
That's right, and they just opened a new storefront.
Yeah, and the thing that I like about 50 Licks is they're actually making their ice cream base. And so they only do direct sales. They're not in distribution. So 50 Licks, I think, has a really interesting dynamic of actually producing the, you know, from cream to cone, the full
from cream to cone. Love it.
So that's a great place to go. Of course, going to the food carts around town, there's so many of them, so I think that's always fun to do. And if I had to pick a third one, gosh, everybody always asks me this question and I can never think of what to say because I have so many favorites. I think probably just going to a farmer's market.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're really special here.
Yeah.
it's hard when you travel around the rest of the country and you go to another farmer's market.
Yeah.
You think, oh, this is nice.
Yeah.
But it's not Portland.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just spent a week in Denver and I couldn't wait to get back to Portland.
All right, we are back with another installment of What's Fresh, What to Do with It, What Other People Are Doing with It. We've got some titles in the hopper. We're brainstorming.
Titles.
Yeah. We'll figure something out by the end of the year when there's nothing fresh in the market anymore.
And then we'll just call the segment Potatoes and Leeks.
How to Survive Winter. All right, so we're back with cherry tomatoes, which a lot of people might think, I know what to do with cherry tomatoes, but I don't think people know the scope of what you can do with cherry tomatoes, because once you get done cutting them in half and putting them in your salad, feeding them to your toddler, eating them out of the pint on the way home from the farmer's market, there's really quite a bit to do with them.
There is. I think for us here in Oregon, we get so excited about tomato season because it's very short. But I think cherry tomatoes is like the first tomato that we see. And mm-hmm. so the first thing you do, of course, is just buy a pint and eat them and then put them in salads and put them in everything. But then there's a lot of things that you can do to keep them around all year.
Yeah. And varieties. There's quite a few varieties, which, I mean, I'll just call myself out and being dumb. I just didn't even think about it. You know, visually you see that there's like a yellow pear cherry tomato, but Sweet 100s, the Sun Golds, which really I think Groundworks Organics has done a good job letting people know that like this is the cherry tomato to seek out.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
I
and
like
then
to...
there's tons.
Yeah, and I like to combine all of them.
Right.
So if you do see the Sun Golds and I don't know the ones that are shaped like a little teardrop.
Yeah,
do you know
what the yellow variety is?
Yeah, those ones are so great. So it's kind of nice to get a couple different ones mm-hmm. and then put them up or can them all together.
Yeah. So I know for me when I've exhausted eating them straight, I like this recipe from Heidi Swanson, 101 Cookbooks, where basically she makes a roasted tomato, almost like a confit out of a pint mm-hmm. of cherry tomatoes. And I just keep that in the fridge and it acts as a base for pasta, for spooning over fish or chicken. I mean, really, it works on anything.
Yeah.
And then I haven't done this, but I love the idea of it. It's always every year I'm like, I'm going to make this tomato tart. But like, the, you know, the puff pastry and the cherry tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So that's how I use them at home. But how do you encourage people to put them up so that in January you can pull down this jar of beautiful cherry tomatoes?
The easiest way is just to freeze them on a sheet pan and then you can put them into plastic baggies. And then you can use them throughout the year for making sauces and things like that. So that's one kind of tip that people don't really think about. But we'll do that so that we can use those cherry tomatoes throughout the whole year.
And so then so you don't cut them, you do them whole?
Mm-mm. Do them whole.
So wash them, dry them, put them on a... cookie sheet or a mm-hmm. sheet tray, put it in your freezer, and then put them into a plastic bag. With that application, then you would only do like heat. You wouldn't really let that thaw. Or does it denature like the structure?
Yeah, you would use it for cooking.
Right.
Like, so you could make a really nice sauce later in the year. And I think that's the thing that people don't really think about with cherry tomatoes is that you can use them for sauces. And they're really great because they have less water
in
them.
And you used some for a soup recently and... I thought, oh, that seems like so much work.
But it's really not. You just dump it in there.
Epicurious also has a great recipe for burst cherry tomatoes and like linguine. So that frozen method mm-hmm. probably could work really well for that. Yeah. You're just adding the whole cherry tomatoes to your saute pan and you're waiting for them to get to that heat moment where they burst.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. I'm going to do that this year because I have 9 tomato plants in my backyard.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So that's one application that I like to use. I also... like to pickle them, which is something that maybe people don't really think about either.
Right.
So especially with the really small, beautiful ones, that's where I like to mix the colors in the jar. Mm-hmm. I have a recipe in the cookbook that's where they're in a basil brine. And so it's this really nice mix of, you know, tomatoes and basil, which go together naturally. But you just, you know, infuse the vinegar with fresh basil, which is around at the same time that you would be pickling this.
And that's in... Preservation.
Preservation pantry.
Coming out in September.
Yes.
Available to order at your website.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask this, because I've seen recipes for pickled green cherry tomatoes. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to do pickled cherry tomatoes, you're wanting the ones that are more firm, or does it matter?
It doesn't really matter. I mean, you want them to be ripe, because that's where you get the flavor. You can pickle green tomatoes. They don't, it's more about the pickle.
Got it.
And not about the tomato.
Got it. And so then how would you use your basil brined pickled cherry tomatoes?
You can use them in any way that you would use a fresh tomato, but they're just going to have more of the, like,
that
acidity.
Briny.
Yeah.
Nice.
And so you can put them into pasta. We like to put them on a tray with goat cheese. Mm. Just anything that you would use tomatoes in, but you have them all year round.
That's awesome. And then what else? I've seen kind of making a sweet confit with them that you can then put on, you know, canapes, your baguette with your goat cheese and a little, like, sweet.
Yeah, there's always
vanilla.
Like tomato jams you can do. But I prefer the frozen method and the pickle method.
Awesome. Okay, so then one of my most outstanding food meal memories is at a restaurant in Southeast Portland. I think I'm going to say the name wrong, but Dirk, you corrected me last time. Acento?
Aconto.
Said it wrong. Aconto. Yes. And it was Romano beans that had been cooked with, not stewed, so like maybe blanched and then sauteed with onions and Kalamata olives and burst cherry tomatoes and shrimp. And I can do without the shrimp, but the rest of the meal, like every summer I think about this dish because it was so good. And up until that point, I hadn't really thought of, you know, cherry tomatoes were snack food, really. Like, I hadn't thought of using them in cooking applications. So how are chefs in Portland using cherry tomatoes on the menu?
Okay, well, I will preface this with, I thought we were doing just tomatoes. So some of the chefs may have just been talking about tomatoes.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about it and then see if it could be a cherry tomato application.
Okay, so first off, and this is a cherry tomato. I don't know the variety, but at Atala, Chef Jose Chesa is doing a super fresh annual salad. So every year when the tomatoes return, so does this salad, which I love. That idea. And so they take pipera peppers.
Which are, we don't have them here, but they're a Spanish pepper that you can buy. They have them at Conserva.
Yeah.
So they're just a really tiny green pepper, but no one really grows them here.
Mild or spicy?
They're not very spicy. Mm. They're kind of long and skinny, and they're you know, how we get them here is pickled already.
Yeah. Could you substitute a padrón pepper?
You could.
Yes.
It would need to be a pickled one, though.
Then they take a torpedo onion, a Gretti sea beans, a touch of vinegar, peaches, cucumber, and albergina olive oil.
That sounds delicious.
That sounds so good. You brought up a Gretti, which I think is something maybe we could tell people about, because I don't know that everyone knows what it is.
No.
Right now, I think Groundworks is the only place that has it, but...
And I had it in a while. I feel like I haven't seen it. I saw it early in the spring.
They had it early, and then they didn't have it last week, but I think they will have it again. Things got a little hot, so it's kind of like the like a sea bean,
right?
But it's an herb, so it's salty. It has a little bit of liquid in it. But we've had it a couple places around town. But it's really nice.
Yeah, the texture is really nice because, you know, sometimes dill, it gets so feathery in your mouth, and this just has, like, just the right amount of structure to it. And peaches and tomatoes go together so well.
I want to go have that.
Yeah.
Next is one of my favorite tomatoes I've ever had in my entire life, and it is a cherry tomato, and it's at Noteguro. So Chef Ryan Roadhouse has a dashi-injected tomato with whipped egg yolk.
I need a minute to process that.
Yeah. It's one of the most magical tomato experiences I feel like I've had. And this is one thing is that it's a cherry tomato, but he has peeled it. So it creates something totally different. Kind of like if you have like a peeled grape.
Right.
Like the texture changes.
Yep.
It's so wonderful.
But his menus change frequently. So is this something that, I mean, if someone wanted to go try, they would need to get there quickly because it might not be on the menu.
No, it's been on a couple times.
Oh, okay.
I think he has, you know, when the cherry tomatoes come around, he does the process that he does, and then he has them for throughout the year. One thing I was going to say about the tomato skin, because he peels them, is that anytime you're processing either cherry tomatoes or regular tomatoes, if you save the skins, you can dry them, and then you can powder them, and you can use it to thicken sauces, you can use it to add color to things. So that's kind of like a food waste tip. If you're going to peel your tomato skins, make sure to save them and use them.
So someone at home might not attempt to inject dashi and whipped egg into a cherry tomato, but even peeling them and adding them to something might just be a chef tip that you can take away.
Yeah. And I would say at Notogoro, if you're not familiar with it, it's a 16-seat diner. You buy tickets ahead of time, sometimes months in advance. But while you're there, he is someone that you can speak to about any dish. So if you sample that tomato and your mind is blown, you can ask him and he'll tell you every single step that went into doing that, which is great because sometimes you could apply those things to home, because he's not doing molecular gastronomy or anything, you know.
He's just doing really cool stuff.
Yeah.
And he'll tell you about it.
And then next we have, let's see. Oh, at Serato, Chef Tony Myers, he's doing a caprese salad. Mm. So, you know, classic.
Yeah. Yep.
But what's interesting is that he takes any of the offcuts of any of the tomatoes and he creates a saffron heirloom broth.
Oh, wow.
And so that... Yeah. He then pairs on the weekend for a special with grilled marlin and a black garlic chèvre potato croquettes.
Two thoughts about that. Yeah, cherry tomatoes. I forget. I don't like to use them in panzanella because they're not juicy enough for the bread. But for caprese, just adding like a variety of texture and colors, I think that's a really smart idea. And then tomato broth. I mean, No, the Spanish had like the tomato bread, but I feel like there's another culture where you sip like the tomato water and it's so refreshing, especially this week on our, you know, trip around the sun.
Heat wave.
Oh, heat apocalypse.
Yeah, I think it brings up a couple of tips of that. Even if you have just like juice left from cutting tomatoes or have pieces that you have taken off because you're, you know, prepping them, that you can use them for other things. So you can always freeze anything that's left over just in a freezer bag and make stock later, which is kind of what Tony is doing.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. And then last...
Do we have an artisan?
We don't have an artisan, and I might have to omit that completely from the format of the show. But we do have a fourth, and that is Joel Stocks and Will Preisch, which brings me to a correction. Last week I said Preisch, and it is not... How you say his last name.
Yeah, we had a lot of listener
feedback. I'm sure there was a big drop-off, I'm sure, because of they were like, oh, it's Preisch. But they are at Hold Fast, and they do a dish with mackerel, tomato water, peeled sun-cooled tomatoes, pureed and fried kimchi, and opal basil.
Wow, sounds awesome.
So tomato water and peeled sun-colds in that dish.
That sounds delicious.
Is tomato water just squished tomatoes?
I think it's the liquid.
Yeah, it's the liquid that comes out.
But do you like strain the seeds out or anything? Or?
They probably in the restaurant. Do. Yeah. I don't know that we would at home. Yeah,
probably not.
Okay, cool.
And then I think listeners would be interested to hear just from your perspective. I know you aren't canning necessarily cherry tomatoes for sauce, but when you use whole tomatoes, you use it all. Seeds, and I know I put up a lot of tomato sauce every year, and I've stopped peeling them because that's a pain in the butt, but I feel like I still have to seed them, but you don't.
No, so we, in everything that we do, we try to use all that we get. So we, you know, we can tomatoes to use for our sauces all throughout the year, but we just do the whole tomatoes. We don't skin them, we don't seed them. I think You can definitely do that if you want to make a very refined sauce that has the perfect texture. But I think part of what we want to tell people about and what we try to pass on is just using all of the vegetable. Mm-hmm. Because you can use all of the vegetable and you can have seeds and skins in your food. And it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with it. And
right.
It's so much easier. And then you're using yes. everything.
Right, right.
So I encourage people to
all
do
right.
that.
I'm not going to seed.
Don't need to.
All right. Well, thank you both. Thanks for chatting tomatoes. And we'll be back in a couple weeks with a new ingredient.
Sounds good.
Yay.
And that's it. That is our show. Thank you for listening. Thank you so much. Please send any feedback that you have to pdxfoodstories@gmail.com, even if it's just to say hi or to recommend products to focus on or producers and chefs and artisans to hear from. And head over to pdxfoodstories.com, where you can find all the show links, everything mentioned today, all the resources that Sarah mentioned, and chefs that Dirk talks about in the cherry tomato segment. Those will all be up on the website. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new food story and ingredient spotlight. So until then, enjoy your summer.